happen.
So today's title is Parliamentary Reform and Chartism before 1842. Today's title is Parliamentary Reform and Chartism before 1842. Okay, so if you have followed the rules, and I know some of you have followed the rules and some of you have not followed the rules, if you have followed the rules, you already know something about Chartism. You are not discovering the word as I talk. Well, that's your problem. So, parliamentary reform. So we've gone through, because remember we're on the history of social movements. I will try to talk a little more slowly today. We're on the history of social movements. We've gone through the rather special case of the movement to abolish slavery, and the rather special case of machine breaking, Ned Ludd and Captain Swing, and so on. And I say rather special case deliberately, because in reality, every social movement is a special case. And very often they are quite surprising historical events. They happen in groups of the population we weren't expecting to get involved in something, and they do things in a different way, and in a way they create history. It's not routine for them. So parliamentary reform. So notice the difference here. Of course, what you have in common with all social movements is people who object to the present situation, either morally, the Quakers, they said it's not Christian, it's not fair to have slavery, or physically, the agricultural workers say we cannot continue like that, we have nothing to give our children to eat, and then what shall we do about it? And what we can do about it is either education and pressure for the abolition of slavery, physical revolt for the slaves, or, of course, machine breaking. And machine breaking is the two sides of that. The first of all, of course, the actual military side, breaking machines and getting away. But secondly, it only really worked because a lot of people supported them passively. And so the sheriffs and the magistrates could not find out who had done it because they had a lot of passive support. So here is a completely different kind of social movement, and in this case it is about parliamentary reform. Now parliamentary reform, they're quite different. Instead of intervening ourselves, breaking machines for example, or going on strike, this is how can we use the institutions which exist to make things better. Bless you. To make things better. Now this took a long time, because of course today we may be sometimes a little cynical about Parliament, we might be, but nevertheless we consider that it's normal that governments decide and we vote for the government, and so even if we don't like it, it's our government, and we will get another chance in a few years to vote again. The local elections are coming up, as you know, and so on. At the time this was not the case at all. A large section of the elite considered that Parliament should not reflect in any way the desires of the ordinary people or the lower classes, and many people in the lower classes also believed that Parliament was not their problem, that it was something which was complete. The idea of democracy was a very, very strange idea for a long time. It became a little less strange after the French Revolution. Because in the 1790s, I don't have the exact history of the French Revolution in my mind, but some of the elections in the French Revolution had a wider electorate than any elections in history, and so it was it was close to universal male suffrage. Also, for the first time in European history, in the 1790s in France, if you were a foreigner and you lived in France, you could vote. Now, even today, if you're a foreigner and you live in France, you can't vote. But in the 1790s, you could. That's not quite true. I can vote in the local elections. I still have British nationality. I can vote in the local elections. Okay, so that's the situation. Now, what is the first big event? The first big event in the history books is the 1832 Reform Act, which is often referred to as the First Reform Act. It's called the First Reform Act because afterwards there was a second one and then a third one. This sounds obvious, but it's not so obvious because, of course, when they introduced the First Reform Act, for many, many people, it was not the intention to go further. On the contrary, the First Reform Act for many people was to stop, that was the Reform Act, the end, to stop democracy coming any closer. We're going to go back before 1832, back to the French Revolution, lead up to 1832, and then afterwards to the birth of Chartism. So what are the big questions here? I'm not going to talk about the detail of the electoral system before 1832. You can find it in most history books. It is extremely boring. But fundamentally, almost everybody could not vote. Yeah, it was a different rule for the towns than the countryside, and a different rule for the university towns again. Very complicated, of course, because traditional. But I'm not going to go into that. But the most important thing to know, in fact, is that before this Reform Act, 450,000 people could vote. And afterwards, 700,000 people could vote. So, after the Reform Act, one man in seven in the country could vote. And of course, how many women? Zero. Yes, zero women. No women. Sorry about that, women. But there you go. That's the life. And people were then, of course, really quite a lot of people were rather unhappy about this. And people were unhappy about it for different reasons. The movement which leads to the first Reform Act is made up of different groups of people who are unhappy for different reasons. It's a big alliance. Yeah, it's not the case that the population united for democracy against the oligarchy. That's not the case at all. You have different groups with different interests coming together, and of course in a big sort of explosion. So the first big question, of course. Now, because when you're looking at history, very often what does not happen is more interesting than what happens. And in this case, the first question that comes to mind is why? Why no real progress before 1832? There were many, many attempts at reform acts before 1832. There were many, many bills. You remember the difference, yeah? Bill, projet de loi, act, loi. Yeah, there were many, many bills. Why did nothing happen beforehand? Well, we're going to have to go back into history a little bit to see which social groups supported electoral reform, when they supported it, and why they supported it. Well, before 1830, before 1830, for 60 years, the dominant force in Parliament was the Tories, and in general, the Tories were very much opposed to increasing the number of people who could vote. Remember that this is the form the question takes at the time. Shall we have more people voting? Most of the critics of the system are not saying, shall we have universal suffrage? No, just more people voting. Okay? So some sort of intermediate thing. So, the Tories were strongly opposed. However, in November 1830, we have a Whig Prime Minister, Earl Grey. I don't know if it's the same man who gives his name to the tea. It sounds like it probably is, actually. It probably is. I could check that if I cared, but I don't. Earl Grey explained to the King that he would like to change some of the system. First of all, he wanted to eliminate some of the rotten boroughs. Now, the rotten boroughs is the historical name we give to towns which had no real elections. Sometimes these are villages with two people living in them, and they have a member of parliament. Yeah? And this is not an exaggeration. Very often they're villages which, in the past, had a lot of people and have nobody left. And so rotten boroughs is the name littéralement, donc des circonscriptions pourries. Yeah, and it means totally undemocratic. First thing he wanted to do, to eliminate some of them. And secondly, one of the problems they had, or one of the problems that the reformers underlined, is that certain towns had no member of parliament. For example, Manchester, Birmingham, Bradford, Leeds. So you have this rather bizarre situation where some tiny villages had a member of parliament, and Manchester, Birmingham, and Leeds, which you have heard of because they had become big over the last 50 years, 100 years, the new industrial towns very often had no member of parliament at all. So this was the suggestion in 1830, but it will be very difficult to find an agreement in a section of the elite. A lot of the elite think some reform is necessary, but which reform, that will always be very difficult to find exactly how. So let's have a quick look at the situation of the je remonte à nouveau, hein? Je remonte 50 ans même. I must reorganize these notes one day. Let's have a look at the elections before the Reform Act. Now, of course, they were not democratic in the sense we mean today. Occasionally, the elections were automatic. There was only one candidate. It was the candidate who was the son of the local lord. There was no problem. Of course, there's no secret voting, so everybody voted for him, and they had a big party. And that was it. But sometimes there were real elections, real competition between the Tories and the Whigs. They would give away food and drink, you know, have a drink, vote for me. And of course it's not secret, so I can see if you vote for me or not. And for example, there was only one polling station, so I will pay for a horse and carriage to take you to votes, yeah? And if you don't vote for me, if you don't promise to vote for me, then I won't pay for it. Yeah, totally. What we would see today is a totally corrupt system. Sometimes the parties spent a lot of money. In Yorkshire in 1807, £250,000 was spent by the parties. Of course, you can imagine that today that is huge. That's the sort of thing that you imagine today for the American presidential elections. Yeah, where they spend a huge amount of money. Yeah. So £250,000 de l'époque in Yorkshire in 1807. So you have this situation which is absolutely not democratic, but you do have elections, and these elections can reflect some demands of sections of the small electorate. The first movements established for having more people to vote were established by Mr. Christopher Wyville. And he established some committees, in particular the Yorkshire County Association. The Yorkshire County Association was established, one, to complain about the cost of the war. Secondly, to demand parliamentary reform. This is very early. This is very early. This is 1783, and the first bill, the premier projet de loi, donc the first bill, will be presented to Parliament in 1783, and will not succeed. So this is the first attempt at parliamentary reform, but it will not be successful. After this, of course, you have the French Revolution, and for a while, nobody in the elite is interested in reform for a short while, because you know it seems too dangerous. You know, it seems you could be encouraging revolution. But certainly on the radical side, many radicals will be radicals in general will be absolutely inspired by the French Revolution. One of the great English poets writes that famous Wordsworth there: "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, and to be young it was the very heaven." Yeah, because for the first time in living history, anyway, of course there was the 17th century in Britain, but for the first time this kind of revolution established. And one of the gentlemen who was the most influential among British radicals was Tom Paine, and he wrote his book The Rights of Man, where he defends his view of society, including the idea of universal suffrage for men. In particular, in his book, he attacks hereditary government. He also asks for old age pensions, family allowances, and the abolition of the House of Lords. It's very 20th century, and its content is absolutely stunning thing. And he in particular attacks the House of Lords and the monarchy because they are hereditary. Yes, you are part of the government because your father was part of the government. What does he say? Hereditary succession is a burlesque upon monarchy. It puts monarchy in the most ridiculous light by presenting it, the monarchy, as an office which any child or idiot may fill. It requires some talents to be a common mechanic, but to be a king requires only that animal figure of a man, a sort of breathing automaton. So he's saying that, you know, if you are king just because your father was king, or lord just because your father was lord, this means that, you know, you need no qualifications to be a governor. You can just be an animal, that's fine. That's no problem. Of course, the British government was not happy with this book, and it was banned. It was immediately banned. Paine was charged with seditious libel, and he decided that he would like to go to live in France immediately. The same day, so he disappeared to France. He announced that he didn't want to make a profit from his book, and he said anybody has the right to reprint it, and the Rights of Man was illegally printed in cheap editions, and we estimate that 200,000 copies were sold in 2 years, which is a lot for the time and a lot for an illegal book. At the same time, many people who sold the book were arrested and taken in front of the tribunals. Also, the government launched a propaganda campaign. Yeah, the government launched replies. Yeah, even at the time where there are no elections, there is still a political debate. And so some of the friends of the government will write pamphlets and sell pamphlets saying, Tom Paine is completely wrong. Here is the reasons. Yeah, it's already a political debate. It's already a political debate. And one of the most famous replies is Mr. Burke, and his book, absolutely famous book at the time, Reflections on the Revolution in France.